Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, a senior security analyst at WatchGuard Threat Lab, and with me is Corey Knockreiner, CTO of WatchGuard. This is our second special edition episode where we'll discuss WatchGuard Threat Lab's recently released Internet Security Report. We'll go over some of the top malware and network attack trends from the first quarter of 2018 and give our thoughts on another record-breaking DDoS attack that targeted GitHub back in February. Hang on tight, here we go. Today, we are going to talk about our just released Internet Security Report for quarter one of 2018. That was fun.
Yeah.
So
great report, by the way. Not sure about the, we call it ISR.
ISR.
What a crappy acronym. The problem is ISR? You mean intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or installation status report, or integrated switch router, or inside sales representative?
We've already all the time.
We've created so much confusion by using ISR. Everyone in the world has an acronym for ISR.
So if you're not familiar with our Internet Security Report, we put it out once a quarter. We generally link it on our blog, secplicity.org, as well as on watchguard.com. And throughout this report, we cover basically the threat landscape as we've seen it for the last quarter. Some of the things we go through are malware and intrusion prevention statistics and trends, including like the top 10 malware samples we detected. Yeah. Top 10 network attacks that we detected.
So really the report is based on something we have here called our Firebox feed.
Firebox feed.
You know, we don't get too vendory on the 443 podcast.
Firebox feed.
but do know that, you know, of course, our podcast, we come from WatchGuard, a security vendor, and we have a network security appliance. And if customers opt in, one of the things these, you know, tens of thousands, really hundreds of thousands of security appliances can do is report back information on.
To the Firebox feed.
The things you were talking about, things like IPS hits, which will show network exploitation, what kind of flaws are being exploited that quarter, or malware hits, whether it be through one of our soon-to-be three different malware engines that can catch malware. So it's all based on real quantifiable data, stuff we're getting from the field, real-world people that have our security and are seeing real attacks from the bad guys out there.
And then on top of that, we dive into some top security incidents that we see during the quarter, like maybe a big network attack that happened or a new method for attack methods that we see. And then we, if we have interesting, cool research to publish, we'll toss that in there as well. So shall we dive into this quarter's report?
Yeah, why not? Let's do it.
All right, let's start with the stats. You want to take the lead on this one?
Oh, sure. Why not? So, of course, the stats are from what you so lovingly have called the Firebox feed.
Firebox feed.
So the stats are really where we kind of take all the quantifiable information from our devices and run it down. Really, the main things we're looking at right now, there's a lot of data we're going to continue to add and evolve to this report. But right now, we're mostly looking at network attacks and malware attacks. For malware attacks, we pay attention to two different services we have. And the only reason this is important to you isn't because of the vendory service stuff, but one of our services is what you might consider a traditional antivirus product. It uses more traditional kind of reactive methods to catch malware. A lot of people say signature-based, which is its primary method. It does have other things like heuristics and more complex rules, but it's primarily traditional anti-malware. Then we have another service, which WatchGuard calls APT Blocker, but the big difference there is that is behavioral-based malware detection. You know, by detonating actual threats in a sandbox real-time in an automated fashion, you can catch brand new malware without any human analysts. So in the Firebox feed, we start by talking about malware data. I would say generally malware was down quite a bit in Q1. It was down at least over Q4 last quarter. It was up, if I remember correctly, over the same quarter last year, meaning it was up a little higher than Q1 of 2017, but down pretty significantly compared to Q4 2017.
And so, that's a trend we've seen now years in a row, right?
Yeah, that is a regular trend. I mean, the first time we've only done, I'd say, just about 2 years of this report. And just, no, a year and a half. but we saw this trend once before. We started this report in Q4 of 2016, and then we did it again in Q1 of 2017. We saw the exact same drop. And we believe it's actually to be expected every year, and it relates to the holiday season. I mean, if you think about the last quarter of the year, there's lots of big events and holidays that are both global and sometimes regional. Thanksgiving, Halloween, Christmas. As far as events, there's different events that go with those, like Black Friday, Cyber Monday. There's even New Year's celebrations that happen right at the end of the year. Long story short, a lot of malware threat actors kind of attach big attack campaigns to these big events. So because it's so holiday rich in the last quarter, we expect to see malware to shoot up in Q4, and thus we expect to see it to drop a bit in Q1.
Yeah. And then on top of that, what about our advanced malware detection?
So that was down as well. Again, this has to do with, again, our signature-based way of catching it versus APT blocker, the behavioral-based. If you just look at APT blocker, the more advanced way of catching it as a standalone, it was down compared to Q4. However, another stat we like to share, the reason I told you the difference between those different malware protections, is one thing we look at is do you need advanced malware protection? You know, a big issue happening in the security industry right now that we believe strongly in is that old school signature-based malware protection is kind of insufficient. It is insufficient. The only reason I say kind of is this isn't to say you should get rid of it if you have it.
No, it's still efficient.
Yeah,
it's efficient at catching the low-hanging fruit, at least.
I'm exaggerating here, but a lot of the stuff is just the same old noise you see on the internet, very common malware samples from unsophisticated actors. Signature-based detection will catch that the fastest. But what we are seeing is the amount of malware that can evade this detection is blowing up. And it's largely, it used to take a sophisticated actor to write custom malware to get past signature protection. But nowadays, there's public tools that will pack encrypt, that will kind of digitally jumble up malware where it hasn't really changed as far as what it does once it reaches your computer. But as it's being scanned when you first get it, it looks slightly different and signature-based detection misses it. So one thing we do is we pay attention to the customers that have both our advanced malware protection and this old school protection. And because of the way our product works, if our advanced protection catches something bad, that means our gateway antivirus, the old school protection, would have missed it. In fact, it called it clean. It specifically missed it. So we compare those two numbers, and one thing that actually went up as far as malware was what we call this advanced malware or zero-day malware ratio. 45.9% of the malware we saw in Q1 2018 would not have been caught by our signature-based protection. It required this advanced malware
protection. So nearly 46%, if you're not using advanced malware protection, you're missing it.
And by the way, that was up by about a point between, so it's up a little bit from Q4, but it was up a lot, I believe, from Q1 of 2017.
It was only 38%, which I say only very loosely because that's
still a heck of a lot.
Large amount of malware to be missing, but it rose even though malware went down from Q4, that percentage of that zero-day malware, as we call it, the advanced malware, still rose.
What this number, and it started to really kind of not plateau, but stabilize around this mid-40%. And to me, what that means is if you don't have more advanced malware protection, you're missing almost half the malware out there. The lowest we've ever seen this number, we were kind of concerned in that, oh, wow, why did it drop so much? It was somewhere around like the 23%. But if you think about it, that's a quarter of malware. I don't want to miss one threat, button.
Would you like to miss 1 in 4 ransomware payloads into your network?
So while malware was down, the amount of sophisticated malware continues to stay high.
Yeah. So how about intrusion prevention? So
talk about that, we should talk about, I mean, there were some standouts do you want to stay high?
Let's go with the stats and then.
Okay.
All right. So how about we jump into IPS stats here before we dive into specifics.
Yeah, the other thing we really pay attention to is our intrusion prevention service. I'm sure most of the listeners of this podcast know intrusion prevention catches software exploits that are launched over a network. So it really is monitoring not so much malware, but the type of network attacks you see. Not just attacks against servers, but maybe even clients. And it could even be vulnerabilities that are exploited in things like Word and QuickTime and Flash. So really at a high level, the overall numbers is IPS actually shot up. And that's a little bit surprising just because of the same holiday ratio thing. I think it went from something like 6.9 million to well over 10 million. So it was quite...
That was quarter four to quarter one?
That was quarter four to quarter one, not quarter one year over year. So a good 52% increase in IPS or IPS hits quarter over quarter. It was also, you know, to your point, an even bigger increase year over year.
150%, I think, is give or take. Pretty massive increase from last year to this year.
So we're seeing a ton of IPS hits. So that was really big. Other than a few exceptions, a lot of it was web-based attacks too, which has remained consistent. And by web-based attacks, that can either be someone targeting web application services, so something you're running on a web server, whether it be directly a flaw in something like IIS, or if it's a flaw in some package that sits on top of your web server, or in some cases it can be a web browser or web client vulnerabilities, meaning the products we use to browse the web could also have vulnerabilities. So that stayed pretty consistent as well.
So how about the details then?
Malware or IPS, which first?
Let's go with malware.
So malware, one of the things we do every year is we have a top 10 list, and I'll tell you at a very high level, the top 10 list didn't change a whole lot. One of the things we're seeing, and I think this is interesting, the protection that we're monitoring right now is network protection. That means we catch the malware before it even gets to the endpoint. Here at WatchGuard, we do have other services that work at the endpoint, but we're currently not putting those statistics in our report yet. So one of the things that's very interesting about our top 10 list is it tends to catch generic malware. And by that, I mean, if you're a security nerd and you notice how malware is delivered nowadays, it's normally in stages because the bad guy wants to get past all your security protections. He's not just going to send, WannaCry directly at you. Rather, he's going to send a malicious JavaScript or a VB script, or he might send a generic Windows program that's what's called a dropper, that it's not WannaCry yet. It's just a small program, a staged program that gets on your computer, then does something else to go and grab WannaCry through some other means that hopefully might evade your security
Maybe
controls.
It's like an encrypted connection back to the command and control
exactly.
server where you can't scan that payload through the network.
And if, by the way, if you can block this first stage of malware, you never see what the threat really is. And for that reason, our top 10 list consistently seems to be this class of first stage malware, whether it be scripts, malicious scripts, or dropper programs. And because of that, we're starting to notice that our top 10 malware doesn't change a lot. We saw a lot of things we've seen every quarter, like Linux dropper, which is just a signature that catches generic Linux scripts that can do bad things. It could be almost any bad thing. We saw a lot of JavaScript-based generic catches, so just malicious JavaScript that could do bad things. We saw, you know, there's signatures that are generic, like there's a Windows 32 heuristic signature that's just generically catches suspicious files that might be bad. So those have statistically stayed in our top 10 quite a bit. And if you've read our past reports, we've explained a lot of them in detail. However, there were two things interesting in the report. One, there was one new named threat that made our top 10 list called RamNit. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right. RamNit.
I'm going to avoid this one. Go ahead.
RamNit if you haven't
yes.
heard of it.
RamNit.
So I call RamNit a Trojan, and by the way, we caught it as a Trojan, but it's actually a very well-known a malware family, started in 2010. It was Zeus. If you've been in the security industry, Zeus was a bot client or a Trojan, that eventually the source code for it, the malicious author that had it, somehow had it leaked. And once it was leaked, a lot of bad actors started creating new malware based on that as the original. Ramnet was one of those. Some people that have analyzed it have called it a virus because some of its capabilities are, besides having something you install on your computer, it can also go to your other executables and HTML files, infect them. Some have called it a worm before because it can spread automatically through USB storage devices and sometimes through network means, at least in the past. But most call it a Trojan nowadays because it really is just a botnet Trojan. It's a generic piece of malware that will give a backdoor on your computer, connect to a command and control channel, and actually can do anything once it has full control of your computer. Lately, Ramnet was mostly being used for what we call banking malware. It seems to be concentrating on trying to man in the middle of your browser and steal banking credentials. So this, for the first time, has showed up on our top 10 list. While it's not new malware, it is suggesting that Ramnet is resurging. And the other thing we noticed about this was this signature caught over 1,200 different variants of this, meaning that the current people spreading Ramnet are making it polymorphic. Their distributing servers are probably automatically chained, packing, encrypting it, what we talked about to try to evade signatures. So that's interesting. But another really interesting thing is it was almost entirely seen in Italy. I believe it was like, Mamma Mia. I think 99%, just a little under 99%.
Were you recently in Italy?
Oh, shh.
Okay, sorry.
I already told the FBI you weren't associated with me. How am I to buy that expensive Honda robot? Yes, I was in Italy. Okay. I'm not responsible. That was technically Q2. It couldn't have been me.
Okay.
My alibi.
Sure. Okay.
So very interesting, kind of an old piece of malware, but we are seeing it resurging quite a bit. If you are worried about it, by the way, we are seeing it over HTML, meaning it's probably being delivered via the web, which is not surprising because often this will start as a infected HTML file. So watch out for Ramnet.
And how about our second big hit?
So the second big hit was kind of funny because we usually use the top 10 list to talk about big new things, but we had to dig much deeper to kind of get this, although subtly it was on our top 10 list, as I'll mention before. So this was the fact that we are starting to see a slow rise in cryptocurrency miners, or crypto miners as they're called. Two reasons for this. I'll give you the easy one first. We don't only look at the top 10 list, we look at a lot of the top malware that we see each quarter. And within our top 25 list, we did see a new rule catching a Bitcoin miner. Basically, it's a signature that catches generic Windows Bitcoin miners. So that, while it wasn't on the top 10, it's inching up within our top 25. I think it was the 24th most common. Yeah. But the more subtle one that took a little deeper dive is one of the pieces of malware that we normally wouldn't talk about because we've seen it over and over again, is that Linux downloader signature I mentioned before. Again, the reason we don't talk about it too much is it's a very generic signature. It's really designed to catch any known malicious Linux script that will go and download additional bad stuff. But when we were looking at the details for this quarter, we noticed that usually that signature will be attached with a lot of hashes. For the non-nerds in the audience, you know, the way you identify an individual file, one way you can do that is you can run a hashing algorithm against it, and it will have a unique hash that matches that file. And a huge majority, again, just around 99% of the hits for Linux Downloader were one very specific file. Long story short, we grabbed that file, took a look at it, and we analyzed the Linux script in our report. I won't dive in. You can see the script in full in the report, but the main details is after cleaning up any previous infections on this Linux device, the victim that it infects, it's going to go in ahead and download a open source a cryptocurrency miner that you can find on GitHub today. It loads a specialized configuration file that the attacker obviously made, and it starts mining Monero. I think it uses a particular algorithm you might know more about, Mark, called Cryptonite. Mm-hmm. And I believe it uses the Stratus. I always forget what's the name of the protocol that...
Oh, it's hooking in with a mining pool in this case.
Yeah, a mining pool.
Yeah. So it's actually, it's interesting seeing that as one of our older, I mean, almost more stale malware samples really switching over to just delivering crypto miners.
And it's not so much it's a stale sample, it's just so generic that it usually represents, it could represent anything.
Stale to me seeing it quarter over quarter.
Quarter over quarter. But it usually doesn't give us much in-depth analysis because usually we see hundreds of hashes associated with it, so we can't check every single bad script. In this case, it was almost entirely another form of cryptocurrency miner, and obviously a malicious one.
And really, this is starting to show a bit of a trend. This is the quarter one report, but we've been monitoring this ever since the start of the year.
Yeah.
Cryptocurrency miners are starting to really take off.
Just anecdotally, we've known about it for a long time, but less anecdotally, even though right now we're talking about Q1, our threat team is looking at this report on a daily basis. So we know some of the stuff happening in this current quarter right now, and we're seeing other crypto miner signatures pop up higher and higher in our top malware list.
By the way, you can monitor this daily as well. Secplicity.org/threat landscape. You go there, we actually have...
Don't tell them. Now they don't have to wait for a report. They could actually generate a Q2 almost report today.
Some of our statistics and interesting
but
knowledge.
But not our cool analysis.
Exactly.
They won't see my write-up on the script.
Corey wants to remain employed, so please continue reading our
wait
report.
Wait a second. Who fires who?
But secplicity.org/threat landscape. We actually have a hook into our database that keeps track of all this firebox feed, as we call it, where you can go in and see the statistics. And really, cryptocurrency miners have been in the top 10, basically daily or weekly lists, almost every single day I've checked it since like February.
Yeah.
They are really starting to take off.
And it makes sense, right? I mean, one of the things that we talked about a lot in the past is ransomware. Obviously, threat actors in the past 4 or 5 years have made a lot of money off ransomware, but it seems to be plateauing. It makes obvious sense that they're pivoting to new lucrative things. You know, about 3 years ago when cryptocurrency blew up, now, obviously, that's a big target on cryptocurrencies back because now that ransoms are being less successful, let's start to steal, you know, either your computer's power or in some cases, I expect we'll also start to see malware that, you know, a botnet now has a module that just searches your computer looking for known wallets and known locations for keys for cryptocurrency, etc.
Guess the good news is we can solve this problem if we just crash the cryptocurrency markets.
Exactly. And your prediction would come through.
Exactly.
By the way, the good news about all of this is the only reason we're seeing this is we are already blocking it. I mean, by definition, everything we're talking about now is something a firebox in the field actually stopped. And we're just looking at it to statistically see what the threat actors are trying to do.
Yep. So that was malware. How about network attacks with IPS?
I got to say, network attack, the IPS, I mentioned how we tend to see a lot of the same top 10 malware because of those signatures designed to catch generic attacks. Our IPS signatures are mostly different. Most IPS signatures are very specific attacks. That said, besides the fact that we saw a whole lot more of IPS triggers, we saw almost no change to the list. There a few of the common threats that have shown up in the top 10 quite a lot, like attacks against Ruby on Rails, some of the more generic HTTP server vulnerabilities continue to remain on the list. I will say, and by the way, one trend I mentioned before, most of the stuff we see being caught by IPS is web-based attacks. That mostly remains the same. One thing we saw happen last quarter, though, by that last quarter, I mean Q4 of 2017, was for the first time two file-based exploits showed up on our IPS list, and they were both Microsoft Office-based exploits. One was a Word vulnerability, and one was technically an Excel vulnerability, but they could both be exploited in any Word document. This time, those two exploits have dropped off the list, but they were replaced with yet another file-based exploit. It again is a Word buffer overflow vulnerability, or memory corruption vulnerability, I should say. And a new one showed up on the list. But to me, it's other than the CVE, the actual specific vulnerability that's being exploited,
similar,
it's not a huge change.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So I would say we didn't see a whole lot different quarter over quarter as far as network attacks. So we really paid a little less attention to IPS in our report this quarter.
So one of the other sections we talk about a lot in the report, or every single report, is the top security incidents, where we go over very newsworthy events and try and provide our own analysis.
Yep.
Without giving away the entire contents of the report, what we went over this time was actually the new record-breaking DDoS attack that GitHub experienced in February of this year. I don't know how many of our listeners use GitHub, but I tend to use it, and when it goes down, it's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
Luckily for this attack, it was only down, I think, for like 10, 15 minutes or so.
It was a very short period one, but it's significant when you have such a popular. By the way, just in case, the only reason you wouldn't use GitHub is you're probably not a developer. If you have developed something, whether it's a script, just so you know, it's a way for multiple people to share and commit code. It is basically a code
management
repository. Yeah.
Very popular one at that, even with the recent acquisition by Microsoft.
Yep.
But in February, they got hit with 1.35 terabits per second.
That's a new record.
New record of network traffic targeted at it. And it actually managed to bring it down. Yes, exactly. That's it. So it was a pretty massive attack. And what was interesting about it is it actually used an exploitation of a new amplification method to amplify traffic.
So let's talk about this really quickly. Like, there's many different ways to do DDoS attacks. I don't think we have time to go through volumetric and attacks versus whatever. But most of the record-breaking DDoS attacks before had botnets behind them. The record before this was held by the IoT botnet Mirai, which got just about 1.1 terabits per second or whatever. So it seemed to be, rather than protocol issues or application issues, it was heavily just pure kind of a brute force DDoS attack where you have tons and tons and tons of attackers participating. So the amplification, which I'm sure you'll explain, is kind of different in the sense that it doesn't necessarily need the attacker to have an army of hundreds of thousands of computers.
No, when
or
using,
at least victims.
Correct. In amplification attacks, they're using some other usually legitimate service that's internet accessible, usually UDP based, so it doesn't need a network or a connection setup. They can just spoof source addresses to it. I go into it much more detail in the report.
Yeah.
But they'll use these other services where they can send a small packet and they as a request to the service, and the service replies with a very large response back to the victim. Yeah. So the attacker only needs a small amount of traffic in order to trigger a very large flood attack of traffic back to the victim. And they actually used a newly discovered service in this one, or at least newly discovered vector.
So one of the variables to this is the scale of the this is not new. Amplification is not new.
No, it is not.
Most people talk about DNS amplification, which is really the first one.
NTP is used sometimes too.
NTP is used often. I think DNS is some of the things you said, like the fact that it has to be UDP. The most common service on the internet is DNS that uses UDP, which is why I think people talk about it the most. But UDP, while I think it's around a 20 to 50 time amplification packet, the packet it sends back in response can be around 20 to 50 times bigger for DNS.
Yeah.
What you're getting to, I think, in this attack is the amplification
Tens of thousands off the chain.
It's just crazy.
Absolutely insane. So very small packet sizes can trigger just this massive flood of data to a unsuspecting victim, GitHub in this case. And we go into it in much more detail in the report, and I'd very much recommend taking a
look. Take a peek. And by the way, the service we're talking about, it just existed. It's very well known and it's established, but not many people thought about the Memcache service, which is basically used to kind of accelerate database stuff, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's the report contents. What do we have for takeaways from this?
Wow, there's lots of them. I mean, the first takeaway right away is this report is only we're generating this information because we have antivirus, IPS, and all these other security services that are already catching this stuff. So if you don't have some of the services in front of your network that catch this stuff in the first place, be sure to use it. But to dive into some of the details, one thing we repeat all the time, advanced malware protection. Signature-based protection is not enough. If you are a WatchGuard customer, make sure you have our product APT blocker. If you're not a WatchGuard customer, think of making your malware protection more robust. Look for new malware protection products out there that use things like behavioral detection.
Sandboxing.
To some extent, although it's still being argued because it's kind of a new technology as far as how they're using it for security, is machine learning and AI.
Skynet.
Exactly. One of the ways you can quickly find new patterns that humans never could see in malware is by machine learning, feeding it huge amounts of known malware and huge amounts of good files. And often it can catch even the malware that people try to sneak past security just because the computer's finding patterns you couldn't. Maybe you should talk about crypto miners. I mean, while I think this will be a heavy topic of our next report, we are seeing signs already of their growth. What can people do about that?
Yeah, so one of the signs of a crypto miner infection is that they use your computer's resources in order to mine cryptocurrencies for the bad guys. And by using your computer resources, your computer runs a little bit slower. So we've probably all encountered that time where we realize, oh man, this computer is slow as heck. I can't open more than one Word window without it crashing. Usually that means some sort of virus infection. And nowadays, that usually means a cryptocurrency
miner.
So keep an eye out for that. There have been some interesting variants I've seen that, like, if you go look in Task Manager in Windows to see your running processes, as soon as you open that up, they'll actually stop running. So they'll hide from Task Manager.
But, well, the other thing that the variant we saw do is it actually uses a well-known open source crypto miner, but it did change the name of it.
Ooh,
so if you do the whole Control-Alt-Delete, you're not going to see the traditional name of the miner. So pay attention to maybe unusual processes that you haven't seen before. And just because they're not associated with a miner, if they're used, you know, look for processes that are CPU heavy that you don't recognize.
Yep. And then when it comes to denial of service, which is what we talk about in the news events section, we really need to make sure that as an industry, we're not becoming a part of the DDoS problem. And that means securing your systems. If you have an internet accessible server, make sure that if you're hosting DNS, you don't allow zone transfers, for example. If you're hosting Memcached, you disable UDP access to it. Things like that to stop the denial of service plague that is really continuing to grow across the industry.
Yeah, it really, we can't give you specific tips for this because, you know, one of the things Mark mentioned is a lot of these amplification attacks need to have UDP-based services. And there's a US CERT released a list that has 20-some UDP services that could be vulnerable to this. But what you have to do to harden each of these services is quite different. You mentioned zone transfers for DNS, but the way you harden Memcache might be slightly different. Or the way you harden your Quake server, which, by the way, is vulnerable to UDP, or I'm sorry, DDoS amplification is a little different. But nonetheless, I mean, generally, do you really need to expose this service to the public? DNS, yes, but some things, really, why do you have it exposed to the public in the first place? So just start there for sure.
Yep. So those are our takeaways. And again, if you want to see a copy of our internet security report, you can get one at secplicity.org/threatlandscape. as well as see all of our data that goes into it and even build your own little copy of it too.
Yeah, whether it be the last year, the last day, or the last week.
Yep. That's it for this edition. If you like the podcast, please rate and review us. You can find me on Twitter at @XORRO_ and Corey at @SecAdept. Let us know if you have any questions or topic recommendations. And as always, if you need your daily fix of security news, insights, videos, and in-depth research, go to secplicity.org. Thanks again for listening. See you later.